wrong idea, but he was certain she would understand once he explained that she could use it. With a proper supply of Aethar, cold air wouldn't be a problem for him anyway. Plus, there was still the blanket itself. He removed the armor and shrugged into the padded gambeson before slipping the hauberk over his shoulders. Then he tugged the mail trousers up and buckled them into place before putting his sword belt back on over the entire outfit. The mail coif went on last, and he was grateful that the armor was enchanted to reduce its weight. Normal mail was entirely too heavy for his taste. Of course, it was nowhere near as protective as the armor he had made for Graham. He often considered making a set for himself like that, but he never seemed to have the time. A rounded helm went over the coif to complete his arming. He didn't really feel the need to wear all of it, but it reduced the size of the pile on his blanket. Picking up the corners of said blanket, he gathered it into a massive bag before hefting it and tossing it over one shoulder. The iron pot let out a muffled clang as one of the other items banged into it. With his staff in his other hand, he focused his perceptions once more and shifted back to the place between, and searching for the woman he had left behind in another world. Karen built a large fire and spent the afternoon gathering fresh grass and ferns to bed down on that night. Having hours for the task meant she was able to assemble a much better pile of bedding than they had had the night before. She quickly regretted making the fire so large, however, for it consumed fuel at a ravenous pace. It wasn't long before she exhausted the nearby supplies of easily liberated deadwood, and she was forced to range farther afield to find more. But she had nothing but time, so she spent her energies building up a large pile of sticks, hopefully enough to last through the night. That accomplished, she attempted to skin the rabbits so she could roast them. It turned out to be easier said than done. Her Swiss Army knife was not the ideal tool for the job. It was much duller than the knife Matthew had used the day before, and she wished he had left it with her. There was also the matter of her being inexperienced at the task. The mangled carcass that was left after she finished removing the skin looked like it had been the victim of a particularly twisted torturer. She decided against doing the second rabbit. If he comes back and he's hungry, he can skin the other one himself. Roasting the badly maimed creature didn't go well either. She had put too much fresh wood on the fire, and the flames leapt too high, licking directly at the flesh, burning it in places, and cooking the exterior entirely too quickly. The first time she removed it to check the doneness, she found the interior meat was still raw. She put it back over the fire and thoroughly burned it before she had it cooked to her satisfaction. Karen was forced to cut away the blackened exterior to get to the edible portions within. Eating as much as she could, she disposed of the rest of her meal. She didn't want Matthew to see the results of her culinary enterprise when he returned. "It's really your fault anyway," she groused, talking to the air. "If you had stuck around, I could have used my hat to stew it. But now that you've left, it no longer holds water." She had found that out the hard way. The water had drained out of her boonie almost as quickly as she could scoop it up from the river. Her sodden headgear sat on a stick near the fire now, drying out. How had he done that? Was he really a wizard? He had claimed he used magic, but she couldn't bring herself to believe it. Whatever power he used had some perfectly ordinary explanation, she was sure of that. Magic simply wasn't real. But how did he vanish the way he did? She wondered. A distant whine slowly built, and it took a moment before her brain registered the sound. Drones? Maybe a pert? She grew excited. Could they have started a search for her? Her father knew she had gone hiking, but he might have sounded the alarm when she failed to check in. Night had just fallen, so she would be even more difficult to spot, and the smoke from her fire would also be less visible. She quickly moved to throw more wood on it, trying to build it up. If the drones above were search and rescue, they would presumably have infrared capabilities. The fire would be a beacon, even if the trees obscured it somewhat. Sure enough, within a quarter of an hour, a dark shape appeared directly overhead, hovering in place. Strangely, it was unlit, and the noise from the fans was almost non-existent, but she could make out its position above as it blotted out the stars behind it. Karen waved her arms rapidly, shouting, "I'm here!" A feeling of relief washed over her. She was saved. A red light and a soft beep alerted STC Donald Aisman that something required his attention. With a thought, he opened the channel and found himself face to face with the first cybernetic division commander, Roald Layton.
Go ahead.
Sir, we have located a campsite within the search region. A young woman is present, and she matches the description of a person reported missing 2 days ago, reported Commander Layton.
Donald nodded.
Another event was reported in that region earlier today, Commander. Does her position correlate?
The commander nodded.
It does, sir, though the zone is still only approximate. We haven't found anyone else in the region. Do you have a positive identification yet?
Yes, sir. Another alert sounded, and the SDC opened it in a second channel. A file popped up containing the information regarding the young woman. Assuming there hadn't been a mistake, the woman's name was Karen Miller, only daughter of Gary and Tanya Miller. Something stirred in Donald's memory.
Tanya Miller. Why does that sound familiar?
A split-second search, and he had the answer. She was a former director of the UN Defense Research Institute. Glancing back at Karen's file, he saw a red link highlighted under her name, Classified Information. It was a top-level clearance item, and probably hadn't even been visible to Commander Layton.
Sir?
Asked the commander.
How should we proceed? I'll need your patience, Commander Layton. There's something I need to review, responded the STC.
Donald opened the link. A code name appeared. Project Blue Star. It was followed by a short warning. Level Black, clearance only. Requests for information or reporting of new updates must be processed by UN President. Donald's brows rose, and he whistled slowly. It was the first time he had encountered a project classified above his security level. He turned back to the commander.
I'll need more time, Commander. Maintain position and keep the target in sight. I will get back to you in a few minutes.
He closed the link. Composing himself, he sent a request for a direct line to his superior. It was denied, but an additional prompt requesting the nature of his request appeared.
Information regarding Project Blue Star, he intoned.
The world vanished, replaced by a featureless void. Seconds passed, and then a chair appeared. Seated in it was his boss, President Angela Kruger.
I hope I'm not imposing on your time, Madam President, said the SDC in a deferential tone.
I'm in the middle of an address to the Council, Mr. Aisman, she replied.
He dipped his head.
My apologies. If you would prefer to defer this until—
No need, Mr. Aisman. My IA replaced me the moment your alert information came through. The Council is not even aware that it is no longer me speaking.
IA stood for Intelligent Agent. The UN President had delegated her speech to an artificial substitute, one perfect enough to deceive those listening. Donald found himself holding his breath.
What have I gotten myself into?
You are aware of the situation, Madam President. Drone surveillance has located Karen Miller in the region of inquiry. Her file flagged me that you should be notified, he said, neatly summarizing the little he knew.
President Kruger's eyes shifted sideways momentarily as she reviewed a file he couldn't see. 30 seconds later, she responded,
You will begin reporting all information regarding this incident to Tanya Miller, and you will obey any directives she issues. Have the assets on site terminate the target immediately. Dr. Miller will take charge of the body afterward.
Obey any directives? Was she putting a retired civilian in charge of a military operation?
Begging your pardon, Madam President, Dr. Miller is no longer even an active member of the government.
The President cut him off.
No one retires from a black-level project, Mr. Aisman. My orders stand as given.
The channel closed, and Donald found himself abruptly back in his chair in the command center.
Re-establish link to Commander Layton, he said, verbalizing his thought.
Chapter 9 Karen continued waving at the near-silent drone, expecting it to give some response. A light, perhaps, or even a sound. But it remained dark. Minutes passed, a quarter hour, and still nothing happened.
What the hell is that thing doing? Is it broken?
She wondered aloud.
A civil search and rescue drone should be equipped with all manner of lights, not to mention a loudspeaker. More than half an hour had gone by when she thought she detected movement beyond the edge of the firelight. Staring into the dark, she lamented the fact that the fire had spoiled her night vision, but eventually she saw the shapes of human forms approaching. A small noise alerted her to their presence behind her as well. Turning, she saw more figures. They were getting closer and coming from all directions. They encircled her at a range of no more than 30 or 40 yards now. No one had spoken or called out to her, though. A shiver of fear pierced her heart. This wasn't normal. These weren't rescue searchers. A log shifted on the campfire, and it flared, shedding a brighter light for a moment. Karen saw the light reflected from the matte black of a painted metal carapace. A white number, and the insignia of the UN Army caught her eye. The forms encircling her in the night were military cybernetic units, androids. Karen held up her hands, trying to seem non-threatening. "I need your help. I've been lost in the mountains for several days." She felt a tremor beginning to shake her body. The air in front of her shimmered, then blurred, as a new figure appeared. Silver metal caught the firelight. Her eyes registered the sight with some confusion, and she thought at first it was another android, but then she saw Matthew's face, grinning at her. "Hello," he said in faintly accented English, as he dropped a large bundle on the ground in front of himself. If his clothing had been strange before, he had managed to take its weirdness to new levels. He was dressed now like some warrior or knight from the Dark Ages. Silver rings covered him from head to toe. "Is that chainmail?" she wondered. A burst of automatic rifle fire ripped through the quiet night air. Karen tried to yell, but everything happened too quickly. She saw Matthew's body jerking as the bullet slammed into his back, while simultaneously something punched her in the shoulder, spinning her around and knocking her off her feet. The silence that followed the loud barks of gunfire was profound, and she turned her head to see Matthew lying on the ground a few feet away. A groan escaped his lips, and he began to sit up. "No, don't," she thought, but he rose before she could form the words to warn him. The drone above suddenly lit up, bathing the campsite in brilliant actinic light, and the soldiers' rifles began firing again, but this time Matthew remained upright, his head turning slowly as he scanned the area around them. Karen held herself flat, sensibly hugging the earth, but she could feel something hovering in the air around them. A wave of nausea passed through her, and then her strange perception vanished. Matthew's face was stern, as though he was deep in thought, while his hands rummaged through the bundle he had dropped on the ground. Guns continued to bark as he searched. Eventually he found what he was looking for, bringing out a small wooden box. He opened the lid and, muttering something, he flung the stones into the air. To Karen's astonishment, they didn't fall back down. Instead, they flew outward to surround the two of them and take up positions around them in the air. Matthew's face relaxed, and then he got to his feet, using his staff to pull himself up. He stared down at her, a look of concern on his features, and then he lifted his staff, leveling it horizontally, as though he held a spear. A dazzling beam of light sprang from the tip as he slowly turned, adjusting the height of his staff as he went to keep his targets lined up. The sound of weapons fire slowly tapered off as he turned, and when he had finished a complete circle, it stopped entirely. The beam winked out for a second. Then he pointed the foot of his staff skyward, and it sprang out again. The drone above them exploded, and flaming pieces began raining down some 20 feet away from their camp. Karen tried to rise, but her left arm wasn't working properly, and pain shot through her chest and shoulder when she moved. She realized then that she had been shot. Matthew stood near her, and his face looked impossibly distant. Pointing the tip of his staff at the ground, he began tracing a pattern of some sort. She croaked when she tried to talk. "Help me," she cried mentally. Her voice wasn't working properly, and she was afraid she might be dying. The young man's eyes caught hers for a split second, then looked away as he remained focused on whatever he was doing. He didn't care. She was going to die. More machine gun fire erupted, and Matthew was forced to stop momentarily to deal with the new threat. A brilliant flash of fire and smoke filled Karen's vision on one side as something exploded near them. Strangely, nothing touched them, though, and she didn't even feel a shock or a pressure wave from the blast. He destroyed the newcomers with another pass of his staff, and then the young man returned to whatever he was drawing on the ground.
"This is insane!"
Karen tried again to rise, but her body wouldn't cooperate. Her legs seemed fine, but anything that involved her torso sent shivers of agony through her.
"I'm going to die, lying on the ground, while he stands there making a target of himself."
Life wasn't fair. Minutes passed, while Matthew continued working on his drawing, and Karen bled. Twice more his work was interrupted by fresh soldiers, but each time he dispassionately destroyed them, before returning to whatever he was doing. The lids of her eyes grew heavy, and Karen's body felt heavy. Something moved close by, and she discovered that she had closed her eyes. Looking up, she saw Matthew lifting his bundle again, before stepping into some sort of circle he had drawn. She got the sense he was leaving again.
"Don't mind me. I'll be fine," she thought wryly.
Then she felt something move beneath her, and her body was lifted into the air. He was watching her as she floated toward him. Matthew made a gesture with his hand, and the stones that hovered around them flew back together, settling within the wooden box he held in his right hand. Settling his staff into the crook of the same arm that held his bundle, he reached out and slid his right hand underneath her, cradling her as though she were a small child instead of a full-grown woman. And then the world changed, wrenching her senses and making her stomach flip. The firelight was gone, and only the moon and stars illuminated the area around them. Gazing to either side, Karen could see that Matthew was now standing atop a large boulder of some sort. He dropped the cloth bundle and knelt to settle her gently on the stony ground. Her body moved as he put her down, and a fresh surge of pain tore at her. A small cry escaped her lips, and then the world went black. Matthew sank to his knees beside Karen's unconscious form. His back screamed in protest. Whatever the enemy had used to attack him in the beginning had pounded his shoulders and middle back like three or four blacksmiths swinging at him with hammers. The armor had prevented penetration, but the padding of his gambeson hadn't been nearly enough to save him from what felt like the worst bruises he had ever had. "If I hadn't put the armor on to decrease the size of my bundle, I'd be dead now." The thought brought a fresh rush of adrenaline. He had probably had one already, but things had happened so quickly that he hadn't noticed. He had kept his focus purely on what had needed to be done to get them away from danger. The enemy had been bizarre, bearing the shape and form of men, but made entirely of metal. He could only imagine they were some sort of artificial construct, powered by whatever magic the wizards of this world used. Karen had been injured by one of their weapons before he had put up a temporary shield, but he hadn't spared a moment to examine her wound yet. Focusing his mage sight, he found the wound to be ugly and bleeding freely. The projectile had entered between her neck and shoulder, shattering the collarbone, before passing completely through and exiting her back. Several smaller blood vessels were torn and leaking, and the entire area around the injury had begun to swell, as though she had been struck by a hammer. It was like a combination of a crossbow wound and a blow from a mace. What kind of weapons were they? He hadn't even been able to sense their approach, which meant they must have flown through the air with incredible speed. He shook his head. "Focus, Matthew. She could die if you don't do something." He began repairing the blood vessels first, stopping the blood loss. Then he turned his attention to her clavicle. The bone had broken into three large pieces, and at least a dozen smaller ones. Fitting them together like a jigsaw puzzle, he managed to get most of them back into place before fusing them together. There were a few tiny stragglers that just didn't seem to work, so he extracted those and discarded them. That done, he condensed a small amount of water from the air and used it to rinse the wound before sealing the skin. Her weirdly patterned shirt was ruined, though, saturated with blood. The two holes in it were a small problem compared to that. In the cold air it clung to her and chilled her skin. He hesitated, but he knew it needed to go. Using his aether like a knife, he sliced it apart on either side of her torso and removed it. Beneath that was the strange undergarment that wrapped around her chest and encased her breasts. It was also soaked, so he cut it away as well. It looked uncomfortable. "She'll thank me later," he told himself, though somehow he doubted it. She had displayed a bewildering number of odd behaviors already, so she would probably blame him for the loss of her restrictive garment. Taking a brief moment to rest, his brain decided it was a good time to remind him that he was holding a half-naked woman across his lap. His eyes travelled the length of her torso, dallying as they moved over her breasts. The light from the moon wasn't bright enough to see them well, but his mage sight aided considerably. For a moment he wondered what they would look like under better light. She was still unconscious. Matthew closed his eyes and shook his head, ashamed of himself for the unworthy thought. In his mind, he could almost hear his father's laugh. The old goat would have probably made a light and convinced himself there was a good reason to examine her. He didn't know that for a fact, but his father did have a lewd sense of humour. No, that probably wasn't true. Either way, now wasn't the time for idle speculation. What mattered was protecting her from the cold and repairing her modesty before she woke up. Levitating her body, he enfolded her in an envelope of warm air before emptying the blanket of its bulky contents. Once it was free of clutter, he stretched it out beneath her. Then he used his magic to wrap it carefully around her, enclosing her in several layers of thick wool. She wouldn't be able to move, but until she woke, he would be moving her with nothing but his power anyway. His second rush of adrenaline began to wear off, and his body began to shake. Less than an hour back in this strange world, and he had already exhausted his aether. Fumbling, he retrieved the small leather pouch from the pile of his belongings and removed one of the iron spheres. Matthew created a small shield around it, then activated it with the command word. He kept a tight rein on his intention as he spoke the word, using his will to alter its meaning. The iron bombs weren't designed to be used in this manner, but he managed to avoid an all-out explosion. The aether still rushed out far faster than he would have liked, but he held it as best he could and directed it inward, absorbing it through his hands. It felt like molten metal racing along the nerves in his arms. Hissing in pain, he retained his focus until he had gotten most of the energy. Some leaked away, but he hurt too much to care. Smoke rose from his hands and forearms. Some of the hair on his skin had burned away. Drawing on an external source of power was something he had done before, but doing it so rapidly, from something like an iron bomb, was obviously not ideal. "I'm going to wind up killing myself if I do that too many more times," he noted quietly. A quiet hum intruded on his senses, and he glanced upward. A dark shape hovered there, too high for his stunted mage sight to detect. They had been spotted. Raising his staff, he tried to destroy the craft, but without his mage sight, his aim was inadequate. Matthew growled. This world was beginning to seriously irritate him. Not for the first time, he wished he dared to fly the way his father did. Flying was not a wise thing for wizards to attempt. It required a lot of practice to perfect, and the learning process was usually fatal. A single mistake could be disastrous. His father had managed to survive the experience because he had been effectively immortal during the period he had first tried it. Matthew didn't have that luxury, but he had something almost as good. He took a small clay disc from the pile of items he had brought, and with a word activated it. Fine lines appeared, and then the disc fractured into 24 separate pieces that flew outward to take up predetermined positions in relation to one another. Investing a small amount of his power in it caused planes of force to spring up between the pieces, and with his mage sight he could now see the broad, roughly disc-shaped craft that rested on the rocky ground in front of him. It was an enchantment that created a nicely aerodynamic shape that would both protect them and make it much easier to fly. Matthew used another word to dispel the portion that served as an entry and began loading their supplies before using his aether to levitate Charon into the craft's interior. Flying would get them to their destination much faster than their original trek down the mountain had taken. It also required a lot of aether, and he worried that, given his environment's outright lack of aether, he would tire far faster than normal, but it was a risk that had to be taken. If they were surrounded again, there was a very real chance that he would run out of resources to fight with before the enemy could be eliminated. Expanding his aether, he took charge of the air around them and used it to lift the enchanted disc into the air. As he had feared, the task was far more draining than it would have been in his own world. The air here was dead, and all the energy had to come from him. Matthew wasted no time as he sent them rushing upward to clear the tops of the trees. The aerial observer followed them immediately, maintaining a precise amount of distance between them. He increased their speed, and occasionally altered their direction, but the thing following them never faltered. It matched his every move with uncanny precision, almost as though it were somehow attached to them. He made one attempt to disrupt its flight, veering toward it and sending an updraft of air to throw the thing off balance, but it adjusted to the change in air currents with only the slightest of wobbles to indicate he had done anything. Eventually, he gave up. It wasn't attacking them, so he decided to ignore it. Their ascent took considerably less time than coming down had taken them. In less than a quarter of an hour, Matthew had found the area where he had caused the rock slide. He guided the flying craft through the rather large opening in the side of the mountain, and watched carefully to see what their tag-along observer would do. It hovered quietly outside the opening, but didn't attempt entry. Moving quickly, he took his staff with him and used it to etch a long line across the ground at the cave opening. Then he continued it up the walls and across the ceiling. That done, he created a quick shield before beginning the more intricate work of inscribing runes along the inside of his initial line. He kept it as simple as possible, but it still took him the better part of 10 minutes to finish his work. He added a second line on the inside of the runes, and then empowered the enchantment with a significant portion of the aether he had just taken from the iron bomb. Completed, the shield should be significantly stronger than a similar barrier made from solid iron. Exhaling a long sigh of pent-up air, he returned to the larger chamber of the cave. Karen was still unconscious, though she moved frequently, groaning in her sleep. He guessed from that her injury must be causing significant pain, so he took a second to renew the nerve block that prevented her from feeling it. She grew still, and the tension in her face eased. Matthew studied her features. Karen had a strong nose, a bit longer than average, but it suited her face. Her eyes were closed, but if they had been open, the blue in them made a great match for the perfect teeth that were currently hidden by soft red lips. She had the whitest teeth he thought he had ever seen, which was made even more impactful by the fact that they were straight and well-aligned, without any gaps. She was beautiful. Not in the delicate or fragile sense that he saw in so many of the high-born ladies he had often been forced to socialize with, but rather in the way she radiated health and well-being. Her unusual height was the result of a strong framework that supported well-exercised muscles. She was still quite feminine, and he almost blushed at the memory of what he had only recently seen. But she was definitely beautiful. "Like a fine horse, strong teeth and good withers," he added, to dispel the awkward turn his thoughts were taking. Briefly, he wished his sister had been present to hear the remark. She would have been horrified. The thought made him smile. A wave of dizziness reminded him that he had already almost exhausted his aether once again. He started to sit, but the pain in his back convinced him to remain standing. Instead, he walked over to Desiccus and put his hand on the great beast's shoulder. "Wake, my friend." One eye in the dragon's massive skull slowly opened, revealing a large yellow iris. Desiccus studied him silently for several seconds.
"That was a dirty trick. How long have I slept?"
"Too long," answered Matthew. "Several harrowing days."
"That's what you get for issuing open-ended commands,"
responded the dragon with a mental huff of disdain.
"Why are you wearing armor?"
"Carrying it was too much of a chore. Wearing it seemed a better option, which turned out to be a lucky choice on my part. I hadn't had it on more than a few minutes before someone tried to put a lot of holes in me."
He kept his tone casual, but he found himself leaning on the dragon's shoulder more out of necessity than by choice.
"Lend me your strength, Desiccus."
A gentle flow of aether made its way up his arm, and the young wizard sighed in relief. Slowly, painfully, he eased his way to the ground and tried to recline against the dragon's belly. His bruises wouldn't allow that, so he eventually wound up laying belly down on the cold stone. He continued drawing a steady trickle of aether from the dragon, and used some of it to warm himself.
"Tell me what's going on. Who is the girl?"
Matthew wanted sleep more than anything, but
but he knew it was a bad idea to succumb to that desire without giving his reptilian comrade at least a basic idea of what sort of trouble they were in. He forced himself to stay awake, and began recounting his recent misfortunes.
Chapter 10 It was dark. Not dark like sleeping outside on a moonless night, but pitch black, with no glimmer of light beyond the occasional flickers created by a brain deprived of external stimulation. There were no stars. Karen felt weird. Her neck, shoulder, and arm were completely numb. She knew they were, only because she could feel their weight and resistance when she tried to move, but she seemed to be wrapped in some sort of heavy fabric. It was warm, for which she was grateful, but she had to fight down a rising sense of panic at being trapped and unable to see. Her bra was gone, and as she shifted, she got the sense that her shirt was similarly missing. "Not a comforting thought," she noted. This was not how she had expected to wake up. Had the military captured them? "Stay calm, Karen. Think it through. What's the last thing you remember?" A vision of Matthew standing in front of her, wearing armor that might have been straight out of the Crusades, passed through her mind. She had been shot, she knew that. It had appeared as though Matthew had also been shot more than once, but for some reason it hadn't killed him. "You're assuming that he's still alive." "Shut the fuck up, Karen. Try to be positive for a change," she told herself.
Something moved in the darkness. Her ears detected a noise like metal scraping across stone. She froze. She wasn't alone. Her heart began to pound in her ears as she listened for any further noises.
"Hello."
The voice that found her was deep, several octaves lower than any human voice should be. It said something after that, and she thought the language might be the same as the one Matthew used, if it was being spoken by something that used a tractor engine for a voice box. She kept her silence, while trying to roll out of whatever was holding her. It took a moment to figure out the correct direction, but once she got it, she was able to get out of the cloth with little trouble. Cold air touched her skin. Her shirt was definitely gone. A short burst of flame lit the cavern, and for a brief instant she saw the massive head of a monster straight out of a nightmare. Thick, scaled lips hovered over teeth that stretched out like daggers, and the eyes that stared at her had slitted pupils like those of a snake. Karen didn't scream. The sound that issued from her startled mouth was something more like the eep of a frightened rabbit. She ran, heedless of her blindness. "Grethak!" The word seemed to penetrate her brain, freezing her muscles into immobility, and she fell forward. Something caught her fall, and a few seconds later she felt hands on her shoulders, straightening her and setting her back on her feet. Another strange phrase followed, and her muscles began to respond again. She recognized the voice. It was Matthew.
"Thank God!"
She clung to him in the darkness, hardly noticing the rough metal that still covered his torso. "It's all right," he told her, sending the words directly into her mind. "We're safe."
"I can't see."
"We're in a cave. You were about to run headlong into a wall," he cautioned.
"There's something in here with us."
He laughed softly.
"That was Desiccus. He's a friend."
She would have gaped at him, but it was too dark for the expression to have meant anything. She gaped anyway.
"Didn't you see it? It wasn't human."
"Of course not. He's my dragon. Let me show you." He tried to step away from her, to create a more respectable distance, but she held on to him, her hands gripping his arm. "Shield your eyes. I'm going to create a light, but it will seem very bright after this long in the dark." She nodded, but then felt silly, since he obviously couldn't see her head moving. "Don't panic when you see him," added Matthew. "He's fearsome to look upon, but I promise he is friendly."
"Okay,"
she responded, steeling herself and lifting her right hand to cover her eyes. A brilliant white light appeared above them, near what she could now see was the center of a cavern some 50 feet in diameter. She blinked away tears as even the small amount of light streaming through her fingers stung her eyes. As they adjusted, she looked nervously across the room toward the massive form that should have been a rock formation. It was too big to be anything else, in a rational world, that is. Apparently the world wasn't rational, though. It moved, and as her vision came into better focus, she could see what was clearly a dragon, a monster from the fairy tales of childhood. It was huge. Legs as big around as saplings, ended in claws that would have made a grizzly weep from jealousy. Vast wings were folded back along its sides, and a long tail was curled around its body, making its position reminiscent of a cat curling up to sleep. The creature's lips drew back to reveal long, dagger-like teeth, and her heart began to pound.
"Stop that," commanded Matthew. "I've warned you about not to smile around people. It makes them nervous."
The dragon chuffed sulkily, but it closed its lips. She hadn't understood his words, but clearly the dragon had.
"He can understand you. Is he trained?"
The young man laughed.
"No, he isn't trained. He's intelligent, as smart as you or me. He can talk, too, but you don't understand our language, so there's not much point."
"I was only trying to be friendly," rumbled the dragon.
"You were trying to scare her," corrected Matthew.
"Not my fault if she misunderstood," said Desiccus.
"You really are talking to it," thought Karen with some amazement. "He's just like a human," said Matthew, before realizing he should switch his mode of communication. "Think of him as a person, just like you or me, but with a different body, and a really weird sense of humor."
The dragon coughed indignantly.
"I take exception to that. I am nothing like your inferior breed of soft-skinned monkeys."
"What did he say?" asked Karen.
Matthew glanced back at her. "He was apologizing for frightening you." Then his eyes took in her bare chest. He had already been aware of her nudity, of course, and he had been trying to avoid embarrassing her by staring, but under the light of his spell he saw her breasts properly with his eyes for the first time. Her breasts were blue. For that matter, so were her stomach, shoulders, upper arms. She was blue everywhere except her face, neck, and hands. Karen saw his expression change, and she shrank away from him, her arms covering her chest. A mixture of emotions ran through her, and she wasn't sure whether she was more embarrassed about her lack of a shirt, or whether she was more chagrined by his discovery of her freakish secret. Matthew looked away and raised his hand. The blanket she had so recently escaped from floated up and crossed the room to enfold her.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to stare,"
he told her mentally. Karen's eyes widened in surprise.
"You can communicate telepathically, even when we aren't touching."
"It costs me more effort," he replied.
"In my own world, that isn't usually a problem, but here I have been conserving my strength."
As the thoughts sank in, she focused on one portion of what he had said.
"You're from another world. You're a demon."
She should have realized sooner, but he had seemed so normal, if one discounted his strange attire. The dragon would have probably tipped her off, but she was still in shock from meeting it. The word she had used, demon, had been new to him, but Matthew had felt the meaning of it in her mind. It referred to the fact that he had come from another dimension, which meant she was familiar with the concept of interdimensional travel. Of course, her blue skin and pointed ears made it plain that she was no ordinary human. She was Shiha. More specifically, she was a child of the Morden Grove. It all made sense now. In this world, the Shiha were fighting for control, and the strange metal monsters he had fought were their enemies, probably defenders of the native population.
"So are you," he responded, his eyes narrowing in suspicion.
"How did the target escape?" asked SDC Aesman.
"Uncertain, Director," reported Commander Layton. "There was a second person with her."
"Show me the video," ordered the SDC.
Twin video feeds were presented in the air in front of them, one showing the scene in infrared and the other using low-light sensors. As the scene played out, numbers beneath them gave an accounting of the exact time.
"Freeze," ordered Tanya Miller. "This matches the time of the latest event we measured with the ANSYS network."
Commander Layton frowned. For something that would produce ripples, it seems very subtle.
"Do you think this may indicate that your daughter is perhaps just a bystander caught up in this?" asked Director Aesman.
Tanya scowled at him, irritated that he had revealed her relationship with the target in front of Commander Layton.
"There is zero chance of that, Director,
and now that your men have failed to eliminate them, the threat level has risen significantly, as shown by their near-miraculous escape."
Layton ground his teeth. "We lost 43 men in that skirmish, Dr. Miller. I would appreciate if you showed a little more respect. Next time you will use appropriate measures, Commander." "It was your own timidity that cost those men their lives," said Tanya, cutting him off. "You should have carpet-bombed the area once you had her location."
"Let's not get into a pissing match," ordered Director Aisman. "We have their current location, and it doesn't appear they will be going anywhere. They've blockaded themselves into a cave with some sort of powerful energy screen."
"Which means absolutely nothing," countered Dr. Miller. "They can leave at any time, in just the same fashion that they escaped your first confrontation."
"Sensors indicate they are still within the cave, though the readings are odd. We show three bodies inside, one of them very large," observed Commander Layton.
Dr. Miller spoke dispassionately. "The entire area must be sterilized."
Aisman was surprised.
"What?"
"You heard me. If an infection is already underway, we need to make certain it is cut out immediately. I want everything within a 2-mile radius sprayed with defoliant and nerve toxins. Use a tactical nuke on the cave," she added.
Layton spoke up.
"A tac nuke isn't the best option. The geological surveys indicate the cave may be exceptionally stable. We have conventional weapons that are better designed for penetrating hard targets."
Director Aisman watched their exchange quietly.
"How can she coldly order the execution of her only child?"
He knew almost nothing about the details of Project Blue Star, but Tanya Miller's hard demeanor spoke volumes.
"I'll start withdrawing our assets from the area," continued the commander.
Tanya held up her hand.
"No. The chemical agents won't affect them. I want sensors to remain in place. We need to know for certain if their biosignatures are still present when the final strike hits. Otherwise, we won't know if it has been successful."
"A high-yield explosion could be dangerous for the men," argued Aisman, "even if it's non-nuclear."
Dr. Miller shook her head.
"Keep them in place. A conventional weapon won't kill your men. If the demons try to emerge before the final strike, have your men use artillery. We need to make sure they don't get out using more mundane methods."
Commander Layton protested.
"You mean it probably won't kill them?"
"I cannot approve of this, Dr. Miller. Your plan will damage or destroy UN assets and equipment while simultaneously endangering the lives of hundreds of military personnel."
Tanya glanced at STC Aisman and raised one brow. With a sigh, Donald bowed to the inevitable.
"Your objections are noted, Commander Layton. Do as Dr. Miller suggests."
Layton was furious.
"Exactly why do we have a civilian involved in this matter, Director? As far as I am concerned, she isn't in the chain of command."
Aisman started to reply, but Dr. Miller held up her hand to forestall him. The look she gave Commander Layton was one of undisguised malice.
"If you don't like your orders, Commander, feel free to take your concerns to President Kruger. If that doesn't satisfy you, I will be happy to have you removed, and we will install someone who will carry out this mission."
The cybernetic division commander blinked and then vanished. Donald let out a deep breath.
"You didn't need to be quite so brutal, Doctor."
Tanya Miller sneered back.
"I had my fill of dealing with fools in the first Demon War, Director. If they had listened to me then, Australia wouldn't be a radioactive wasteland. I will brook no delays this time."
She disappeared then, leaving the senior defense director alone in the command center. Donald Aisman lowered his head to cradle it in his hands. This was going to be a long week, and he didn't see any way that he would be getting out of it without losing a significant amount of skin, assuming he was able to keep his job at all. Chapter 11 Matthew could see the denial in her face. Karen lifted her chin, refusing to let shame hold her back. The truth was out already. She put her hand on her companion's face to make certain he would hear her thoughts.
"You are mistaken. I was born here. Both of my parents were born here. I have a condition known as methemoglobinemia. My blood doesn't handle oxygen properly. That's why my skin is blue."
More came across in the link than just her words. He also felt her shame.
She seemed to think she had some sort of disease, or perhaps there was a social stigma associated with her condition. He also knew it was a lie. He had never seen one of the Morden Shiha with his own eyes, but he had lots of memories of them. Her skin, ears, even her curly black hair were all indicative of that heritage. Not to mention the fact that he had just felt her project her own thoughts without his assistance. She was already beginning to use Aethar without even realizing it. He brushed away her hand, then tested out a phrase in her language that he thought was correct. "Close your eyes." Karen glared at him, but eventually decided to trust him and did as he asked. Matthew channeled his power along his right arm, making sure it was brilliant with Aethar, but not allowing it to glow visibly. With a word, he cancelled the spell, sustaining his light sphere above them, plunging the cavern into darkness. Then he drew back his arm and swung at her head, as if he were about to deliver a stinging slap. Karen reacted instinctively. Turning, she deflected his arm and then caught it. Matthew had intended to stop his swing before reaching her cheek, but he found himself flying through the air instead. The air burst from his lungs as he landed on his back, and pain exploded through his body, blotting out everything else as his back arched. The bruises on his back were screaming at him as he twisted into a knot on the floor. She knelt over him. "Oh, God, I'm sorry. What were you thinking?" He got the gist of her words, but the agony in his back was too much for him to reply. He waited for the pain to pass, and after a few minutes it faded slightly. Restoring the light sphere, he frowned up at her before trying to sit up again. His back had other ideas, however. "You're hurt," she exclaimed. "No shit," thought Matthew. She began trying to remove his armor unsuccessfully. He struggled with her briefly, but it hurt too much to maintain his resistance. Surrendering, he showed her where the buckles were, so she could remove his coif and detach the hauberk from his mail leggings. Several painful minutes filled with swearing went by before she finally had the chain shirt and his padded gambeson off. Desicus had been watching the entire time, but now he broke his silence. "If she kills you, can I eat her?" Matthew sent a silent response. "We already talked about this. No." Secretly, though, he thought it might be a good idea. "Besides, wouldn't you prefer to eat the one already dead?"
"She looks tender," replied the dragon, before adding, "Smells better, too."
Karen ignored their conversation as she helped him to roll onto his side. A whistle escaped her lips as she saw the state of his back. Black and purple splotches covered his skin. In places, there were dark spots that indicated blood had pooled just under the surface, hematomas. She had felt bad about throwing him before, but now she wondered how he had even managed to stay on his feet. He had to have been in a lot of pain. "You need a hospital," she said at last. "There could be a lot more damage than we can see." He only understood part of what she said, but he replied anyway, again using her language. "I'm fine." She sat back. "You're learning English very quickly." That line went over his head, so she put her hand on his forehead and repeated the phrase mentally. Once he understood, she replied, pointing at himself. "Good memory."
"Something is coming,"
Desicus notified them, lifting his head and turning it slowly. "I don't hear anything," said Matthew. The dragon snorted.
"I have better hearing."
With Karen's help, he got back to his feet and made his way to the entrance. Outside, he could see more flying machines hovering, and he thought there might be soldiers on the mountainside, but he couldn't be certain using only his eyes. Again, he was frustrated by how limited the range of his mage sight was in this strange world. Karen stood next to him, squinting against the morning sunlight. "Jets."
"What's that?"
asked Matthew. She put her hand on his shoulder.
"Military aircraft. They have missiles that can destroy all sorts of things, and they can fire from miles away."
The concepts were strange to him, but the meanings carried through.
"How soon will they fire?"
"They could have fired before ever getting this close," she replied.
"They're doing something else, though that doesn't mean they won't."
He was still coming to grips with the amazing things these people seemed able to do with dead metal and absolutely no Aethar, but he got the feeling they had little time. They needed to leave. But then he was standing next to a Morden Shiha.
"Karen, you have to understand something. You aren't from this world. You are Shiha. Your blue skin is a feature of theirs. Well, one of them, anyway. The same goes for your ears. For some reason, she wanted to believe him, but she couldn't let go of her past for a wild fantasy. She had had parents, a childhood. She knew better. When it was dark back there, you saw my hand coming. Only a mage could do that, he added, refusing to relent. You are a Morden. You've just never been exposed to magic before. And what does that mean? She asked. Why is it so important to you? The Morden can teleport. It's a special ability that only they possess. You can get us out of here. She had definitely experienced some odd sensations over the past few days, but at the moment the world seemed entirely normal, if one discounted the fact that she was standing in a cave with a dragon and a self-avowed wizard. She couldn't help but laugh. So I'm a wizard, and my special spell is teleport. There's no way I'm high enough level to cast that. The words were accompanied by some strange mental images, and he got the feeling she was referring to a game of some sort. She wasn't taking him seriously, and if what she had told him was true, they might not have much time. He walked back to the interior chamber and weighed their options. He could try to construct a better defense. With Desiccus, he had access to enough aether to create something truly spectacular, but he didn't think that would be the best option. He couldn't be certain how powerful the weapons of this world might be, and if they dug in, they were bound to eventually be overwhelmed. Escaping on Dragonback was a slightly more attractive option, but he had seen the night before how effective the flying machines were. He doubted they could escape pursuit, and once in the open, they would be much more vulnerable. He tried to bend down and retrieve his armor, but his back made that nearly impossible. Putting it on would be even worse. Matthew sighed. Using his aether, he gathered it, along with all his other gear, into a small pile. He left out the iron pot. It was too bulky, and since Karen was using the blanket, he had nothing large enough to wrap everything up with. He used his armor instead, piling the other items on it and wrapping it around them, before tying it together with the rope. Karen had been observing quietly. "What are you going to do?" It took him a few seconds, but he was able to slowly pass the meaning of her words. Then he replied, "I'm leaving." "You can teleport?" she asked. The answer was too much for his limited language skills, so he put his hand on her shoulder. "No, I don't have that gift, but I can move between worlds. I'll return to my own world for a while." "What about me?" "You're welcome to come. I wouldn't recommend staying here." The thought of traveling to another world both frightened and intrigued her. She didn't have much to keep her anyway, other than her parents, and her current situation didn't offer any good alternatives. Karen nodded. "I'll come." Matthew pointed to Desiccus. "Climb up there." He didn't have the vocabulary to be more descriptive, but he thought the idea should be fairly clear. The thought of climbing up on the massive beast was a fairly daunting one, but the dragon crouched low and extended one forelimb, obviously offering her an easy route up to his back. It turned out to be more difficult than she had expected, mainly because she was limited to using one hand. The other had to keep a good grip on her blanket, or it would slip off. "It's a little late to be worrying about your modesty now, Karen," she thought. "You've already given them quite a show."
"Don't worry. I'm only interested in your body as a gustatory experiment."
The voice in her head wasn't Matthew's, and she knew instantly it came from the dragon. It startled her so badly she almost slipped and fell. Matthew watched from below with some concern, ready to catch her if she lost her grip entirely.
"I didn't realize he could talk the same way you do," she announced.
"Imagine my shock," said the dragon. "How would you feel if you suddenly discovered your food could talk?"
"That's enough, Desiccus," cautioned Matthew. "This is unsettling enough for her without your bad jokes." Karen kept her attention on what she was doing until she had firmly seated herself. Matthew clambered up next to her and sat in front of her, just behind the dragon's neck.
"He doesn't really eat people, does he?"
she asked, hoping the dragon wouldn't be able to understand her language. Matthew laughed.
"No."
"Not yet," added Desiccus, guessing at their conversation.
Matthew laughed, and Karen forced herself to relax. The creature was obviously trying to be funny. She hoped.
"Tell her that skin-to-skin contact is best. Neither of you is wearing a shirt after all.
The dragon's remark carried a mental smirk. Matthew tensed, uncertain whether the message had been relayed to both of them or whether it was private. That isn't funny, Desiccus.
You were thinking it,
the dragon told him.
No, I wasn't.
You are now.
Charon broke in. What isn't funny?
His magic will be easier if you cuddle, explained Desiccus.
Okay,
she answered aloud.
What?
Exclaimed Matthew, but before he could say more, he felt her arms around his waist, and her head came to rest on his shoulder. He tensed, but then he realized the blanket was still between them. A faint tremor ran through his back as Charon began to laugh.
She has a better sense of humor than you do, announced the dragon.
I should leave both of you behind, muttered Matthew,
and before they could tease him further, he shifted them between worlds. Chapter 12 He didn't want to return to the cave. Matthew was sick of mountains in general, so he tried to land in a different place. He didn't really have any way to pinpoint his arrival, aside from directing them away from the place he had left before. As a result, they appeared somewhere unknown to him.
This seems nice, opined Charon,
squinting to keep dust out of her eyes. A strong wind was blowing, and it kicked up sand from the hard-baked earth that stretched out around them in every direction. Desiccus shuddered and began to move beneath them. The two humans slid off quickly, and watched curiously while the dragon began to retch. Charon laid a sympathetic hand on the creature's shoulder.
Are you all right?
I'm never going to get used to those shifts. It gets worse every time, complained the dragon.
Charon felt fine. The moment between worlds had been a little disorienting, but it hadn't bothered her stomach at all.
It's just a hairball, commented Matthew spitefully.
I don't have hair, argued Desiccus.
You will when I'm done with you, responded the wizard, if you don't stop making jokes at my expense.
Several minutes later, once Desiccus had recovered, they mounted up again and began searching for a better place to rest. They flew north, since they had no idea where they were. One direction was as good as any other. Charon had some serious reservations about their mode of transportation. She had never been afraid of flying, or had any problem boarding commercial planes, but being on dragonback was a different matter. Their altitude was a brute fact, far more immediate than the sterile heights she had experienced looking out of a passenger window. She kept her cool, but she had to keep forcing herself to unclench her hands, which were digging into her fellow passengers' ribs like claws. The strangest part of it all was the complete lack of wind. When Desiccus took off and began to gain speed, Matthew did something. She sensed it for a moment, a flickering around them, some sort of domed enclosure. Within it, the air was calm and relatively warm, which was a necessity considering Matthew's bare skin. He didn't even have the benefit of a blanket. A quarter of an hour passed, and the desert continued to stretch on before them with no end in sight. While the temperature was fine in their protected bubble, the sun was brutal. She saw the tops of Matthew's shoulders begin to turn pink, and she began to feel bad for him. Having lived her entire life covered in sunscreen, she had a healthy respect for the effects of ultraviolet rays. The solution was obvious.
Don't think about it, Charon. It's a purely practical matter, she muttered to herself.
What? Asked Matthew, failing to catch her words. Unfolding her blanket, she pulled it around his torso to wrap them both within it.
Shut up, she told him. Don't say a word.
He held himself as still as a statue from that point on, hardly daring to move. Charon scooted back slightly, keeping a small distance between them. There was no need to get closer after all, until the dragon suddenly dropped several feet, pretending to have encountered some unexpected turbulence. The distance between them vanished as she held on for dear life. Desiccus sent a thought to his young master.
You're welcome.
I'm making steaks out of you after this is over, Matthew responded privately. Count on it.
Oh, so it's fine for you to eat dragon, but it's somehow wrong if I want to indulge in the same sort of culinary exploration. How is that fair?
Another hour passed, and the two passengers grew more at ease with their strangely intimate situation. Charon's fear of falling had faded, for the most part,
and an important question rose to the foreground of her mind. Neither of you know where we are, do you?
Not exactly, answered Matthew.
What does that mean? She probed.
Desiccus broke in to clarify.
He means we have no clue.
Matthew ground his teeth.
We could be in the northern wastes or the southern desert. That's why